the 148,000 Americans who are on the ground in Iraq, Congress is thinking of cutting their pay at the same time that Halliburton and Lockheed Martin and Boeing are getting billions in contracts.
There's people who don't want to be there anymore, be it just because they hate what they're doing or they hate what they stand for. Nobody wanted to be there. Nobody wanted to fight the war. Nobody wanted to get shot at. Nobody wanted to shoot anybody else.
People in the communities around these hospitals, around these cities, are having trouble getting to them because of checkpoints, because of the barriers being put up by the wall's construction and the wall itself.
For the modernization of the Arab world, you have to pull the thorn out of the side. That is the Arab-Israeli peace process.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, August 14th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Rebels lifted their two-month siege of Liberia's starving capital today, and dozens more U.S. troops came ashore, significantly increasing the American presence and support of West African peacekeepers. With a handshake between Brigadier General Fettus Okonkwo of Nigeria and rebel leaders on the middle of a frontline bridge, insurgents ended an offensive that had brought down President Charles Taylor, killed well over 1,000 civilians, and left hundreds of thousands more trapped and starving. The White House announced today the capture of a man described as al-Qaeda's chief representative and operational planner, calling his apprehension a significant blow to the enemy. He was identified as Ridwan Ismamuddin, also known as Hambali. His capture is another important victory in the global war on terrorism and a significant blow to the enemy. That's according to White House spokesman Scott McClellan, who told reporters aboard Air Force One as President Bush flew from Texas to speaking engagements in Southern California. A senior administration official described the suspect as, quote, one of the world's most lethal terrorists, and said his group, Jamaa Ismailia, was linked to last year's Bali bombing and a series of deadly church bombings in the Philippines. He is also a leading suspect in the JW Marriott bombing in Jakarta and a close associate of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged September 11th mastermind who was captured earlier this year. The U.S. military apologized to the people of Baghdad in a neighborhood today for an incident in which a man was killed after a Black Hawk helicopter blew down an Islamic banner. Yesterday, American forces fired into a crowd of 3,000 demonstrators in Sadr City, a Shiite Muslim town, after a man shot a rocket-propelled grenade at the soldiers, according to the Associated Press. The shooter was killed and four bystanders were wounded. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, commander of coalition forces in Iraq, says, quote, our intent is not to alienate the Shiite people. The conduct of our operations is to take into consideration the Iraqi culture and sensitivities, and we want to be precise in our application of combat power. Well, numbers dominate the recent headlines and sound bites from Baghdad and the Pentagon. 147,000 U.S. troops are currently on the ground in Iraq. 265 is the number of servicemen and women that have been killed since the beginning of ground operations. 130 of those deaths have occurred since May 1st, the day Bush declared combat victory for the coalition. $3.9 billion is the number of U.S. dollars that Donald Rumsfeld estimated it costs per month to support U.S. efforts in Iraq. $400 billion is the projected military budget recently approved by Congress for fiscal year 2004. And the list goes on. What many reports lack, however, despite all of these statistics, are the real details. When it comes to who is doing what in Iraq, the facts are often less clear. How many Americans know who supplied the war? Who is in charge of reconstruction? How much they are being paid for it? And how they were hired? The answer is not quite so simple as the predictable response, the military. Few people know the real details, how the projects and personnel planning post-war Iraq come from private American corporations making world-class lemonade out of the sour situation in the Persian Gulf. So begins a new report issued by the New York-based World Policy Institute. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Institute researcher Frieda Berrigan about the price of freedom in Iraq and power in Washington.
We looked at who's profiting from the war in Iraq and found that many of the companies that are making a lot of money, billions of dollars, on the war in Iraq are companies with close ties to the Bush administration.
Really, though, we've heard these reports before. I think Halliburton and Bechtel are almost household names nowadays. And so none of this really it seems particularly new, since we've known for a while that private corporations have played major roles within the Pentagon. But your report goes into a great bit of detail about exactly which contracts have been awarded to which corporations and how much influence they've had in forming these administration policies. Can you tell us who some of the major players are that you investigated?
Sure. I mean, a great place to start would be Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin is the largest weapons manufacturer in the country, and it's the largest weapons manufacturer in the world. 80% of its business is with the U.S. Department of Defense and with the federal government. So it really has almost no business that's not directly connected to Washington policies. They've had huge increases in the defense contracts that they have garnered. Their first quarter sales for 2003 are up 18% over 2002. They've gotten a number of big contracts for weapon systems that have been, the stocks of which have been depleted by our war in Iraq, and their assembly lines are working overtime. But their political machine is also working overtime. Bruce Jackson, who is a former vice president of Lockheed Martin, quit to become a full-time lobbyist and proponent for U.S. foreign policy. He was part of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. Your listeners will remember that in the fall of last year, as our government was trying to make the case for war, a bipartisan independent, so-called independent body was established to sort of help in that effort to win the hearts and minds of the American people, to get them to march behind the drumbeat of war. Bruce Jackson, former vice president of the largest weapons manufacturer in the world, was part of that body.
And what was the name of it?
The Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. And he played a crucial role. Remember that so-called old Europe, France and Germany, who opposed the war, were confronted by a new Europe. These 10 countries, former Soviet states, former Warsaw Bloc states, that signed a letter in support of the United States and the British war against Iraq. These 10 countries didn't just get together independently and decide on their own to do this. Bruce Jackson drafted that letter. He was the machine that made that happen. And that, you know, it was a critical part of convincing the people of this country, convincing people in Congress who were opposed to the war, at least, you know, not fully behind it, that these 10 countries, all of whom, you know, have experienced some level of regime change in the last, since the end of the Cold War, coming out behind it. So it was sort of a, you know, PR coup that Bruce Jackson was able to pull off. Lynn Cheney, who's the wife of Vice President Dick Cheney, is a former board member of Lockheed Martin. And until Cheney got into power, she was making $120,000 a year just for going to, I think she had to go to 4 board meetings a year. Of course, she had to quit that job when her husband became vice president. I can imagine that she maintained some sort of relationship, that Lockheed Martin has some sort of access as a result of that. One final example of this sort of web of relationships here is that Chris Williams, who's a lobbyist for Lockheed Martin, sits on the Defense Policy Board. People will remember that the Defense Policy Board gained some media attention because of the extracurricular activities of its chair, Richard Perle, who finally had to step down as chair, although he remains very much on the board, stepped down as chair because of, almost a dozen clear instances of conflict of interest between his position as the chair of the Defense Policy Board with the ear of Donald Rumsfeld and other people in power in Washington, and his own, investments in the Boeing Corporation, in Homeland Security companies, and in other weapons manufacturers. So Chris Williams, who's a lobbyist for Lockheed Martin, sits on the Defense Policy Board, and so enjoys incredible access to information. The Defense Policy Board gets classified reports from Congress, from the Pentagon. They advise Donald Rumsfeld on foreign policy and military issues. They have offices in the, you know, they have their meetings in the E-ring of the Pentagon, which is the inner circle of the Pentagon. Mm. So again, we see just one more layer of influence. Of course, Chris Williams, who, you know, makes hundreds of thousands of dollars a year representing the interests of Lockheed Martin, sits there and says, war would be good for us. Using this kind of weaponry would be good for us. Pursuing, you know, A, B, or C policy would benefit the company that puts food on my table.
And so one aspect of your report that I think really deserves particular mention is the close connections between the Bush administration and several of these corporations. That's evidenced both in campaign contributions and in several of these corporate leaders holding government positions, such as you've identified somewhat, members of the Defense Policy Board. Can you speak about the campaign contributions?
Each of these companies gives hundreds of thousands of dollars to members of Congress who are running for re-election, for ponying up tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars for the Bush campaign in 2000. Just one example is the Boeing Corporation, which currently I think is one of the largest recipients of corporate welfare, and is really in dire straits at the moment. It contributed tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars when Bush was declared the new president, when he ascended to the presidency without the benefit of the popular vote. Boeing put out $100,000 for the inaugural party, and has also contributed $1.5 million in soft money and political action contributions throughout that campaign. And 60% of that went to Republican candidates. And they've gotten back on their investment since the Bush administration has come into power. You remember that right after September 11th, 2001, Congress passed a special bill that was aid to companies that had been particularly affected by the attacks of September 11th. Boeing got a huge grant, essentially, from Congress. I think it was, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was over $1 billion that went to Boeing because they're a large, you know, manufacturer of commercial aircraft, and they, you know, they were sending out the red flares about how their commercial aviation sector was going to be affected by this. And then, just recently, Congress passed a special Boeing bill, essentially. Boeing had convinced the Air Force to lease, to essentially rent, these new huge transport planes that Boeing is making. And so the Air Force said, well, we don't really need these planes. We already have plenty of these planes. And we're using them, and we don't really need any more. And even if we did need them, we would purchase them outright. But because Boeing needs our help, we're going to lease these planes for, you know, about 30% more than we would be able to buy them for outright. And just as a sort of gift to get Boeing, you know, to sort of help Boeing along.
At the taxpayers' expense, I would.
Exactly. So Boeing got this gift, again, just recently, in the last month or so, from Congress to help it limp along. You'll remember that in June at the Paris Air Show, the United Arab Emirates chose an Airbus, a European company's planes, over Boeing's planes. And so this was sort of the booby prize that Congress gave to Boeing because they didn't get this billion-dollar contract from the United Arab Emirates. This bill was attached to an emergency supplemental to pay for the war, and it's practically impossible for members of Congress to oppose these emergency supplementals. Since September 11th, I think we've had four supplementals that have gone to pay for the war on terrorism and the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. And each one of these ends up being a little pork pie for members of Congress. They can add their own agendas, their own the things that they want, the pork for their communities, onto these bills, because these bills are going to pass, and they're going to pass very fast. So this most recent supplemental that Congress passed, President Bush asked for $74 billion to pay for the war in March, and Congress turned that bill around in 3 weeks. The House and the Senate agreed. They added $4 billion more dollars to the bill, and they gave it back to the president. So there's very little debate, there's very little scrutiny, and there's very little opportunity for members of Congress to call each other into some sense of accountability.
Is this a relatively new phenomenon of private corporations working so closely with the government, both in the waging of war and in the post-war reconstruction? Or is this something that's always been going on, but just not at the scale that it's currently taking place?
I think there has been private money going to elected officials and all of these connections. I mean, it was 40 years ago that President Eisenhower warned of the undue influence wielded by the military-industrial complex and warned of the disastrous rise of power that they can use. So that's 40 years ago, and I think in World War I and World War II, we saw individuals and companies profiting from war. But I think that when we look into the future, and we have this war on terrorism, which is a war that our administration has told us might never end, might last lifetimes, might last generations, they really have a whole new ability to manipulate foreign policy towards profit and towards individual gain. What's interesting is there's an article in the newspaper today about how the troops, the 148,000 Americans who are on the ground in Iraq, Congress is thinking of cutting their pay right now, that they would lose $150 that they get every month as a special family separation compensation. They would lose the $75 that they get every month because of the imminent danger that they're under, imminent danger pay. Congress is going to cut this money at the same time that Halliburton and Lockheed Martin and Boeing are getting billions in contracts. There was an article about a week and a half ago about the living conditions of Army personnel in Iraq. The Army has signed $8 million in contracts with Halliburton's subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, $8 million in contracts with KBR to build troop housing in Iraq. Troops are living in tents, you know, that are dusty and dirty, not air-conditioned, full of bugs, and they're still living there, even though these contracts have been signed. Why? Because KBR can't, because of the insurance that they have to pay for their civilian contractors, and they're afraid of putting their civilians in harm's way. These modular units, air-conditioned units for the troops, are sitting on some dock in the Persian Gulf somewhere. And meanwhile, the wives and families and mothers and fathers of these young men and women who are in Iraq, who are being killed in Iraq, are scrimping up to send air conditioners, to send building materials to their family members in Iraq, so that they can sort of make little shelters for themselves.
Frieda Berrigan is a researcher at the World Policy Institute's Arms Trade Resource Center. Her group recently released a report entitled The Price of Freedom in Iraq and Power in Washington. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Benghazi. A British soldier was killed and two others were injured in an attack on a military ambulance in Basra, Iraq today. The army ambulance was hit by an explosive device hidden in the earth next to a lamppost. Officials say it was activated by remote control. Daily reports of incidents like this have unfortunately become commonplace as the occupation continues past its 100th day. And tensions and frustrations among U.S. troops continue to rise as their tours of duty continue to be extended and amidst today's Pentagon announcement of a proposed pay cut. Earlier this week, Peace Watch correspondent Dante Toza spoke with a U.S. Marine who's just returned from Iraq about his experiences and his perspective on the war.
My name is Michael Hoffman. I was serving in the U.S. Marines as part of 5th Battalion, 11th Marines in the actual conflict in Iraq.
What was your post?
I was in the Fire Direction Center, which means I was in the basically the brain center of our firing battery. So all radio communications came through us. Any kind of fire missions, which is another unit telling us that they need artillery fire, came through us. So I saw all the radio communications going through. All the cars were fire. I heard a lot of what we were shooting at when we were shooting.
So what were you shooting at?
A lot of things. Our main job in the early war was called counter battery, which basically means if the Iraqis shot anything like mortars, howitzers, rockets at us, we have a radar that can track where the round comes from, and then we'd shoot back at it.
So where were you?
After the initial stage of the war, we just got thrown around. We were called a reinforcing battery, a reinforcing battalion. So wherever the major fight was, we would go to that area and help support them. We would reinforce their fires.
And where were those locations?
I was outside of Al-Basra, Baghdad, Nasiriya.
So how long were you at each places?
Only a day or two. Some of the longest time we spent was in Tikrit. We were there for, I think, a little over a week.
So how long were you actually in Iraq?
I was actually in Iraq for, you lose track of time there, but I think it was about 2.5 months.
2.5 months?
Yeah.
So what was it like in Iraq?
It was really interesting because I didn't see a lot of the frontline combat. You know, I wasn't face-to-face with Iraqi soldiers, but I did see a lot of things like we dealt a lot of times with the civilians.
So why were you dealing with the civilians?
We were in their backyards. We would literally set up our firing positions in the farmers' fields. Like, you'd be sitting there. We would pull in. I was part of Vance Party. We were the group that actually get in there first and set up the area for the battery.
Do they know that you're coming?
They know we're coming when we show up.
So they didn't know, they didn't have any, like, advance notice?
No advance notice. They just knew a war was going on, so people were probably going to be running through their backyards.
So how did they react to, like, Americans coming onto their farmland, per se?
Some of them just kind of sat back and hid. Some actually come up and start talking to us. We set up in this one person's backyard. It was like a farm field. It wasn't planted as far as I could tell. But we set up there, and the family actually lived. It was actually their land. We could tell there was a larger house set up there. They took off in the morning. Like, they were kind of sticking their heads up at night. But the neighbors were all coming over the hills. It started off, you know, with kids. Kids are curious. So you'd see, like, these little kids, maybe 5, 6, 7, sticking their heads up looking at us. And then, you know, some guys be near them, so they, like, throw some candy from their MREs or something to them. They pick it up, eat it. And next thing you know, the parents are coming over, and
it sounds like they're pretty friendly.
Yeah, they were very friendly. A lot of them, all the ones I met, even when we got towards Baghdad, and even Tikrit, which is Saddam's home, even there, people were generally friendly towards. They wanted us, they're like, you know, get rid of Saddam. They didn't like Saddam. You know, if we were there to throw him out, good. Throw him out. Get rid of him.
Why do you think the U.S. went to war?
Oil.
Oil?
It's our first sergeant, who's the highest-ranking enlisted man in our battery, would actually, he shoot away all the officers, because that's one thing they do. They kind of push him away and say, you know, this is the enlisted talking. This is our battery. We're going to talk now. And he's talking, and he told us, make no illusions about it. You're not heroes. You're not over there to save democracy. You're not over there to free the Iraqi people. You're there for one reason alone. He paused. The whole battery, it's like 120 of us all replied in unison, oil.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't like a hidden thing. We weren't sitting there thinking we're great protectors of democracy. I mean, yeah, we felt good when we saw the Iraqi people rooting us on, but we knew the real reason.
So when there was look saying that, you know, the whole claim was like they're looking for some kind of biochemical weapons.
Right. I wasn't that scared about it. Even the NBC guys who were giving the classes, I got a chance to talk to them more one-on-one because I was the only NBC-trained person in my battery.
What is NBC?
Nuclear Biological Chemical Warfare. I was the only one trained in NBC week-long school a few years ago that goes through everything, decontamination, testing areas, all that. I sat there and talked to him, and we basically came to the agreement that it was a joke.
Why?
Because even if he had the stuff, which we were both highly in doubt of, because you can't hide – they're acting like they're hiding the stuff. You can't hide the means to develop this stuff and produce it in mass quantities like that. And even if it was buried underground, we would see them digging it up. We would know they're digging it up. And before they even had a chance to use it, we'd bomb whatever they were digging into oblivion. Now, even if they did dig it up, they did have it in weapons form. The only way they had to hit it with is because they had no air force – was indirect fire, things like rockets or artillery. Their rockets were really inaccurate, things like Scuds. Scuds were designed to hit things like cities. When the military, when we were actually in combat, we were moving in small groups. The rockets would come nowhere. They wouldn't be able to hit us on the first try in any way. And I went back and told everyone else in my unit. Everyone else in the unit was terrified of biochemical weapons. And when I sat down and explained how this worked to them, they're like, okay, so now I'm worried about landmines.
So you in particular realize this. You're like, well, what am I doing out here? Do you question that?
I knew from this get-go I was there. I was there for oil, you know? I mean, we sit there and we will count days until we're out. Just because we're so sick of putting up with everything, you know, being told what to do. I joined and thought I was going into artillery, but I think I spent more time cleaning floors than doing anything concerning artillery. You know, there's people who don't want to be there anymore, be it just because they hate what they're doing or they hate what they stand for. Nobody wanted to be there. Nobody wanted to fight the war. Nobody wanted to get shot at. Nobody wanted to shoot anybody else. But we knew in order to go home and get this over with, we had to get to Baghdad. I didn't want to go, like, before I even went, I tried to contact a conscientious objector group to get help to find out what I could do, you know, and I never got any response from them.
So what do you see or experience that you think most people in the U.S. doesn't know about?
Overall, like, the devastation of things.
What's the devastation from?
A lot of it is just, it's not individual small arms. It's things like artillery, rockets, the big things, explosives, you know, bombs, things like that. Like, the one time that, you know, just, you call it the horror war really hit me is we were traveling and we just got to an area. There's just, like, the smell in the air. It was really horrible mixed smell. You could smell, like, burning rubber, fuels. You see, like, actual, like, tanks and stuff melting from, like, white phosphorus rounds. And then we're looking, like, what is that thing? And then somebody goes, smells like burnt hair. And then we realize it's probably people that were smelling that were still in the vehicles that were burning. Because there's no way you'd be able to pull people out of things like that.
How will you compare the two military forces?
From what I saw, the Iraqi military, it didn't pose any kind of a threat. I think Bush knew that. That's why he kept talking up the biochemical thing. We were actually in Tikrit. They told us that we might go to Tikrit, then have to fall back because they saw a lot of tanks sitting out there. None of them could move. They were abandoned. Like, they were missing parts. They didn't have fuel to run them. The soldiers weren't being fed. The desertion rates, especially early on, were incredible. We just rolled down the road, and we would see deserters walking down. And you knew they were deserters because the only pair of shoes they'd have were military boots, what was issued to them. So they walk around barefoot because they didn't want to be identified by their boots. So they left the boots behind, put on civilian clothing, and just walked away.
So why did you join the military at the time?
At the time, I wasn't going much of anywhere with my life. I went to college for a semester. Didn't really take. I was tired of school. I was trying to write. That wasn't going anywhere. Then my friend was joining up. He's like, hey, why don't you talk to the recruiter? So, okay, I talked to him. And he, you know, played a lot of feelings. Like I said, I wanted to see the world, you know. I wanted to try to make a difference in the world. Like, for me, when I joined up, the big thing in the news was Kosovo and the quote-unquote, you know, ethnic cleansing, things like that. And of course, now I find out that, you know, the ethnic cleansing actually, or genocide, if you want to call it that, got worse after we joined up than afterwards. So I'm sitting here after the fact going, oh my God, just the reason I joined was wrong.
So how do you feel about all those things that they told you now?
I saw the world. Not always the places I wanted to see, not always in the best situations, but he left out a lot of things, like the fact that, you know, I've got that extra 4 years, but he didn't sign out till I was had my pen right to the paper. I was about to start signing my name. Then they tell me about that. I'm like, well, I'm signing already. And actually, I served over 4 years active duty. I did about 4.5 because they were able to extend me like that because of that 4-year extension, something they also don't tell you. I was about to get out. I was actually a few days away from actually getting out, starting my term of leave, and basically not being touched. And then all of a sudden they turned around and extended me.
What do you know now that you wish you would have known when you got recruited?
Just the whole state of American foreign policy is what really, you know, the American intervention is just, you look at the history of it, it's just, it's almost grotesque. I mean, you see things like Panama, which is a joke from when it was first created by American businessmen with military backing. You know, the Marines, you know, American businessmen set it up and then they call in the Marines to back him up when he starts having problems. Just look at the history of things like that. And that's what really gets me.
What are you planning to do now, like, with your life and, like, where are you going?
Right now, I want to get more active in a lot of things. Different movements, different, you know, I'm new to the whole area. I've just gotten out of the military. I've only been kind of reading and educating myself on this for maybe 2.5 years now. So I know I still have a lot to learn, a lot to understand.
Why do you want to be interviewed? Why do you think your views should be publicized?
Just my experience is letting people know that, you know, just because you're in a place like that in the military or something doesn't mean you have to go with the flow, that there is hope out there. There are chances, you know, to make a difference.
What other message do you hope to bring to our listeners? Like, what do you hope that they get out of it?
I hope better of an understanding of what was going on over there. You know, that not everyone out there was doing it, you know, because they think that we can do no wrong. That we actually do think, you know, just because you're in the military doesn't mean you're brain dead. You have no opposing views. You automatically agree with everything the president says.
What would you say to President Bush if he was listening to this program?
Get us out of Iraq, out of Israel, out of every single country we're messing around in, because we're not doing any good. We're doing more harm.
Michael Hoffman is a U.S. Marine who's just returned from Iraq. He spoke with Peace Watch correspondent Dante Toza. Thanks also to Hannah Sassaman for production assistance with that piece.
This is Anthony Sloan, a.k.a. T, from the Patterson's Taking a Train to Tibet, the engineer and sometimes sound gatherer for Pacifica's Peace Watch. I do hope you're being informed by our efforts here. If you find what we do valuable, please make a financial commitment to Peace Watch so we may continue our work on your behalf. Kindly make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at pacifica.org. That's PICIFICA.ORG. Or you may send us a tax-exempt donation via check or money order addressed to Peace Watch, care of Pacifica, 2390, that's 2390, Champlain, Champlain, Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you on the front lines. Peace.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.